this second experiment is the laser reflector.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. We have invited Dr. Gerald Pollack to initiate our series of interviews about water, as we are at the Solari preparing our next annual wrap-up on the theme of water in all of its aspects and in the wide variety of realities that connect with water that is so basic to everything on this planet and in life. Dr. Gerald Pollack is a professor of bioengineering at the University of Washington, Seattle, where he still maintains a laboratory and conducts groundbreaking scientific studies that are changing our understanding of physics and biology or life. All of his three most important books won Distinguished and Excellence Awards. In 1990, his book, Muscles and Molecules, Uncovering the Principles of Biological Motion, in it he describes how muscles contract and relax, and which was already based on a recognition that cellular water plays a role. And this led to the 2006 publication of Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, A New Approach to Cell Function, which details the role of cell water and the gel-like state of the cytoplasm, something that Solari subscribers have studied with me in the wave genome and the quantum holography of DNA. And this culminated in 2013 in the publication of The Fourth Phase of Water, Beyond Solid, Liquid, and Vapor, in which Dr. Pollack describes the discovery that water is not always H2O, but also occurs in a fourth phase of structured water with a chemical formula of H3O2. And all of this is ultimately will be our topic today. Needless to say, something as fundamental as water leads to all kinds of areas of physics, biology, engineering, and even consciousness that we are going to address. Since 2005, Dr. Pollack has been organizing an annual water conference, and he is the founding editor-in-chief of the scientific journal Water. He's also founder of the Institute of Venture Science, to which I will return at the end of our conversation, and which is a consortium of people to explore new ideas of science that are not funded or that are challenging our existing paradigm. I could not find a better person to speak to in order to initiate our water interview series than esteemed Professor Gerald Pollack. Welcome to the Solari Report, Jerry. I cannot thank you enough for being here. Would you like to describe to our listeners and to our audience, what is your discovery? Why is it so unique? And why is it silently changing the way we are seeing life and the processes in the living cell?
Well, thank you for the glorious introduction, Ulrika. I will try to fulfill your wishes. Okay, so what is the fourth phase of water? To start with, we know there are three phases of water, right? The solid, liquid, and vapor. And I think the fourth phase is somewhere closest maybe to a liquid or in between a liquid and a solid. So in a solid, all the molecules are connected to one another in the form of ice. Mm-hmm. In the liquid, the molecules are randomly disposed, bouncing around a fierce number of times per second or per millisecond or even femtosecond. In easy water, or fourth phase water, I'll explain later why we call it easy water sometimes. Mm-hmm. The molecules are in a structured state, an ordered state, and It's kind of like a crystal, or you might say a liquid crystal. This has, of course, there are a lot of properties of it, which I can and will discuss. But one of the important features of this is that it's the kind of water that fills your cell. Now, if you read the textbooks, you'll find that what fills the cell is liquid water. And the way you can dispel that false notion, very simply, is to take a razor blade, if you're brave enough, and cut yourself. And if you cut yourself, if the cells are filled with liquid water, liquid water would come out as from a breached water pipe. It doesn't. That's not the case. It doesn't come out. And oddly, I was discussing that yesterday with a surgeon who performed some minor operation on my shoulder. And you know, I mentioned this to him, and he said, "Oh yeah, well you're right. You cut through tissue and such, and the water doesn't come pouring out." And the reason it doesn't come pouring out is that it's not liquid water. It's actually gel-like water, and that gel sticks to the solids inside the cell. It may seem like
solids in the cell.
Pardon me?
What would be solids in the cell?
Well, the solids would be the proteins mostly, and nucleic acid. Proteins occupy some 70% of the inside of the cell. And the protein, the change in conformation of the protein, is usually what we ascribe to cell function. So, for example, in the contraction of muscle, the idea is that the actin and myosin proteins undergo some conformational change, and this change brings about the contraction. And similarly, in, for example, secretory cells or nerve cells, the idea is similar, but few people take account of the water. So or I should say few scientists take account of the water. If you read a biochemistry or cell biology book, you'll hear about water in chapter one, emphasizing its importance. And then you don't hear about it again, because the water in the cell is considered nothing more than a background carrier of those more important molecules of life, like the proteins, nucleic acids, and such. According to what we found in many follow-up studies in different areas, essentially what the cell does how the cell works is as follows. This is our thesis, and this is elaborated in the second book you mentioned, The Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. So when the cell is in its quiescent state, that is when it's not doing a whole lot, the water is fourth phase water, or this organized liquid crystalline water, and the proteins, the workhorses, are in their extended state, and nothing serious is happening, and nothing can happen in that state, because nothing moves. Everything is stable. When the signal comes along, for example, when the signal for the muscle to contract, there's a change, a massive change that occurs inside the cell. And this change is commonly referred to by physical chemists as a phase change. Everything changes. The water undergoes a transformation from this ordered fourth phase water to ordinary liquid water. And the proteins then, together with the change in water, the proteins undergo a change from their extended state to a new conformation. And that new conformation is really what, and the change of water are really what are responsible for doing the work of the cell. And then after the frog catches the fly, it returns. The water and the solids return to their original state. And by the way, that's the energy requiring state. So in essence, what I did in that Sales and Gels book is to adduce evidence for what I just told you, a kind of general paradigm of cell function.
What you're saying is that in the natural state of the cell would be that of the ordered water, and then when there are when there's work being done, it goes into a phase change into liquid water, and then yes, back into this fourth state of water.
Absolutely, yes, mm-hmm. You've got it exactly right. You're probably going to ask me, but I should go on and say something about the electrical effects, because we found out that the fourth phase of water is in fact negatively charged. Typically, it's negatively charged. When you realize these findings were achieved using tiny micro electrodes that were actually plunged into the fourth phase region, and we found to our surprise, we expected neutrality, but it turned out to be negatively charged. If you start from water, which is neutral, and you see a distinct region that's negatively charged, mm-hmm. Then there must be another region that's positively charged, because you know it has to add up to neutral,
yeah.
Right? So, and we found that. So typically, the way the experiments ran initially is we put a material like a gel, for example, in water. And we added some particles to the water. Usually we added little tiny spheres called microspheres, which are used widely in scientific studies. And we found that the microspheres, that there was a region next to the gel where the microspheres were no longer there. And that's why we called it the exclusion zone at first, or in the U.S., EZ. It's easy to remember, but unfortunately in Europe, it's EZ, which doesn't work. It doesn't work quite as well. So you've got this negatively charged EZ or fourth phase zone, positive charges we found beyond that. And so you've got negative charges, positive charges, that's a battery. Now, if you have a battery contains, potential energy, the ability to do work. And we found, indeed, that this can do work. And so the bottom line of that is, for cell biology and for cells, it's not just ATP, that the splitting of a high-energy phosphate bond in ATP that does the work. But also, it looks as though this electrical charge or battery-like effect also does work. And by the way, I should mention that we actually have a proof of principle of this, because we're able to stick two electrodes, one in the negative, one in the positive, and get real electrical current enough to light an LED. So this energy is real.
From a cell.
We did it from the preparation that I was talking to you about, but the cell is more or less the same. So if mm-hmm. you think about the cell, I think many people know that the cell is negatively charged. If you stick an electrode or two electrodes, one inside, one outside, the inside is more negative with respect to the outside. And what's the reason for this? There are two points of view. Our point of view is that the cell is filled with easy water. Easy water has negative charge. Therefore, the cell has negative charge. It's very simple. The conventional view, supported by almost everybody in biological science, is that the membrane of the cell contains pumps and ion-specific channels. And the action of these ion pumps and channels together somehow is responsible for building the negative charge inside the cell. I take exception to that because of at least a half dozen different arguments that I've published in various places. But just let me give you in one. Because this is so widely held, but I believe it's wrong. If you remove, if you think about the cell, cell is often thought of as a gel-like entity, and it is gel-like. For example, you can take raw egg white, surrounded by a membrane, and the proposition is the action is occurring in the membrane, the ion transport and such. But if you take just a simple gel, without a membrane, without pumps, without channels, without any of that, and you stick an electrode in, you get the same electrical potential as you get if you stick it in the cell. Therefore, it's hard to argue. It's hard to argue that the action is occurring in the membrane.
Right.
As I said, that's one of half dozen different arguments, which are beyond the scope of.
I don't know if you have heard of the work of Professor Michael Levin from Tufts University. He has done experiments on planaria worms. And what he has done is by simply changing the potential on the cells, he was able to, for example, grow a limb or grow an eye. He was measuring the potential of organs, electrical potential, applied it or reconstructed it. He did use something like ions and then was able to grow a limb or grow two heads on the worm. So it seems to me that this would be possible. It's not the membrane necessarily or the ions, but it may be simply the electrical pattern. And that could also be created by the structured water. Is that could that be a right reasoning?
Yeah, I think so. The electrical potential is critically important, and and for me, it's simply a reflection of the amount of easy or fourth phase water that you have in the cell. And then in Levin's case, it's possible that by manipulating the electrical potential, he's changing the amount of easy water that water that exists inside those cells. And one of the critical points that I was beginning with in the Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life book is that the relaxed cell, the inactive cell, is filled with easy water, and the electrical potential is a reflection of the amount of easy water. So if you got a lot of it, then you'll have a big negative electrical potential. If you have a little of it, then you have a small and negative electrical potential. But in order to function properly, since the function involves a transition between the easy and liquid water, you need to have the plenty of easy water there to begin with. So by artificially changing the electrical potential of the cell, you could be doing that. You could be building easy water.
How else would easy water be built naturally in the cell?
There are several ways to do it. The first is using infrared light or infrared energy. I didn't mention it, but in order to build this electrical potential, in nature, you can't create energy. I told you about the battery-like feature with negative and positive, but that can't come from nothing. All you can do is transform one kind of energy into another kind of energy. This is a fundamental feature of
thermodynamics.
Energy can be neither created nor destroyed. It's only changed. So the question is, well, if you build a battery like this, where does the energy come from? And and I tell you, we struggled with that question. We couldn't figure it out. And I always like to say I was scratching my head so much, and that's why I lost a lot of the hair on my head. And finally, a young undergraduate student with no experience or background practically at all found it. He was doing an experiment similar to the one that I described a few moments ago with a gel or a polymer or something in the water and the microspheres and such. And he happened to notice a lamp right next to him, one of these gooseneck lamps. And he was curious. So he pulled the lamp, took the lamp and shined it on the chamber. And the region that was illuminated, the exclusion zone, fourth phase, grew. And it grew by a very substantial amount. And the part that was unilluminated didn't do anything. So it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that it looks like light is responsible. Mm-hmm. The energy, photon energy, is responsible for building the EZ. Of course, we immediately followed up on his observation, and we did experiments. And the obvious experiment is to figure out which wavelength is responsible, because you know the incandescent lamp that he had sitting next to him contains a variety of wavelengths, from ultraviolet at the short end through the visible spectrum and at the long wavelength and to the infrared. And so we studied a variety of individual wavelengths spanning that range. And we found that ultraviolet did nothing. Visible light did essentially nothing until we got to the long wavelengths of red, and there we could begin to pick up a little effect. And if we went to longer wavelengths, into infrared, then it grew by leaps and bounds. It was really really impressive to see. We could easily get a 10 times expansion with a very weak infrared light. And so we concluded from that that the energy is coming from infrared photons, infrared light. And the light infrared is incident on the water, and it builds easy water. It's the energy for buildup. So the requirements are in the paradigm that I just stated are that you need a hydrophilic surface like that of a gel, water loving surface. Polymers do it also, biological surfaces, many surfaces, but you need infrared energy. And what I haven't told you, and a lot of people don't know, they think infrared energy it comes from the sun. We feel warm, and mm-hmm. that's true. That 50% approximately of solar energy is in the infrared region. And you know, if you turn on your electric oven and you open it, you could see the glowing orange mm-hmm. coils. You know, and they generate heat. And it's common to say, "Oh, yeah, it's generating infrared energy." But in fact, infrared energy is being generated by everything around you. If you were to turn off all the lights in your room, and I came so that you couldn't see anything with your eyes, and your cell phone camera couldn't record anything. If I came with a camera with a lens, an infrared sensor. That is a sensor similar to the one an ordinary camera is, but sensitive to infrared light mm-hmm. instead of visible light, completely dark. I get a beautiful image of the roses sitting to your right and the picture sitting to your left and your lovely necklace, et cetera, and you. that's why the military uses it for night vision. So everything is generating infrared, and that means that infrared is omnipresent. It's always there, which means that if you have the right situation with water, some of that water is going to be EZ water. fourth phase water.
Would it also mean that in to some degree, at least, we could communicate with cells by using light, even, you know, light signals?
Yeah, well, sure. Light does something. It grows easy, charges the water battery, so to speak. But there's more to it. And that is, I think, what you're alluding to. I'm not sure, but I think it has to do with information. Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah. These are areas I would love to touch upon after describing the easy water. Is that if there's signals from light, it's even ambient light that seems to be working on the internal water of the cell.
Yes.
There should also be the biophoton light that comes from the cell itself, that comes from the liquid crystal structure of the proteins and macromolecules and DNA, as Fritz Popp has shown, as it opens and is transcribed, also emits those biophotons. So it comes from inside and out. Maybe there is a way of figuring out certain patterns and signals that can communicate with the water, can create more of the structured water, and perhaps, as you were indicating, that could be a reason why water holds information. Is that
that certainly is a possibility. You know, the information in water has now been described and confirmed by enough people, enough independent scientists, that there's really little doubt that it exists. And the remaining question is, how does it work? And the energy that's responsible. I can tell you a few of the experiments if you like.
Okay.
But the energy that is responsible for carrying this information is less well known, less understood. And obviously light can be some kind of electromagnetic energy, which light is, could be the nature of the information carrying system could indeed be light. It could be something else, you know. We don't know. There's a lot we don't know, and we don't know what we don't know. You know, you think when electromagnetic energy was first discovered, I guess that was about 250 years ago or something like that. Before that, it was completely mysterious. And now it's less mysterious, still a little mysterious, but it's less mysterious. And so the possibility exists that there's another kind of energy that we simply don't know about. We need to learn about this. And that's obviously the job of scientists. You know, many scientists have deeper interest in looking at phenomena that are already well known, and to sort of, as we say, dot the I and cross the T and pursue incremental changes. But we learn a lot more if we look at the fundamentals and we discover something brand new.
Yes.
Many scientists tend to reject anything that doesn't fit within the mainstream view.
Right. Just like you discovered something in essence brand new, a new state of water, a fourth state of water. I think it's this is a groundbreaking discovery. And by the way, I've been looking, and it's not only you, no longer. Now, I've, for example, in 2020, it was published in Physics Review Letters from the University of Stockholm that water can behave like a liquid crystal when illuminated with light. So this is a whole scientific article also from other sources now coming out. And also Russian scientists are confirming the higher conductivity of the interfacial water, which is another name for the easy water, isn't it? Because it builds at interfaces compared to bulk water. So this is changing, I think, the paradigm. And if you were allowed to simply speculate, if you want, what kind of energy would that be that has the information or that creates that information?
Oh, you know, I would like to be able to speculate, but I'm really not sure. I'm speculating on many things, but here I have really nothing to speculate on. I can speculate, however, on the mechanism by which the information is stored. So if I may, if that's interesting for you. Okay. Well, so I look at a digital computer memory, or simply one of these memory sticks, this thumb drive that you stick into your computer. It stores information. And the question is, do the physical properties of this information storage resemble the physical properties of easy water? Now, I haven't talked about the structure of easy water yet, let me start with the computer memory. So it's basically a planar chip, and on the chip, it's got transistors that are regularly arrayed at discrete points on a grid. And they have the capacity, each one has the capacity of effectively changing state. And there is generally called zero or one or on or off or something. And it's the distribution in this two-dimensional array of zeros and ones that contains the information. Okay, this is pretty standard. Yeah. And the question is, is the structure of the EZ similar? Does it have some entities that are regularly disposed and that can change state? And the answer is yes, resoundingly so. So it turns out, I wish I had a diagram here, but I don't. It's okay. So the way the structure of the EZ, as we've been able to deduce, is a planar structure. So you have, think of a surface, a flat surface, the surface of a gel or the surface of a hydrophilic surface, and water interfaces with it. And so the first molecular layer of water molecules undergo a transition, and the transition into a sheet-like interconnected structure that's basically a series of hexagons, a honeycomb structure, you know, hexagons linked to one another. And that serves as the template for the growth of the second layer, which also is exactly the same as the first layer, but shifted slightly from it, and the third and fourth and fifth. And by the way, parenthetically, those hexagons are so small, and that has a real implication because remember, you've got those hexagons are negatively charged, and the positive charges are sitting in the water beyond, and so they're protons that originally came from water, and they latch onto water molecules, giving you a so-called hydronium ion or positively charged water molecule. Now, those positively charged water molecules want desperately to recombine with the negative charges. And the reason they can't do it and they're kept out is that the holes in the hexagon are too small to admit them. So they stay separated. And therefore, you have the battery. Without that, you wouldn't have a battery because positive and negative will immediately recombine. But they remain separated. Okay, so that's a side issue. But going back to the issue of information storage, basically you've got a regular array not only in one plane but in multiple planes, which is, you know, could be advantageous. And in each honeycomb sheet, It consists obviously of hydrogens and oxygens because the source was water. Well, it turns out, as far as I understand, hydrogens have only one state, but oxygens have five different so-called oxidation states. And this is standard chemistry, although maybe advanced chemistry, but it's well known. The most common one is minus two, which we call the valence of oxygen, minus two. But there's also minus one, zero, plus one, and plus two. So to summarize, the easy has the two characteristics that are necessary, that are similar to what you have in a thumb drive memory. Entities that are ordered, not only in two dimensions, but here in three dimensions, and entities that, atoms, molecules that can undergo a change of state. And here, instead of two, we got five.
Wow.
So the answer is yes, at least theoretically, the easy has the capacity to store information, a similar way to the thumb drive, the way the thumb drive is able to store information. And that's cool.
That is cool. And especially considering those five states of the oxygen, that would be enormously more information than in a binary situation like in the thumb drive. It almost sounds like a quantum computing setup.
Well, I could never understand exactly how a quantum computer works, but forgive that. But yeah, it turns out that those five states make a difference. But what makes an even more profound difference is that we're dealing at the atomic level. Computer memories now are at the transistor level. So when you go from the transistor level to the atomic level, you can cram a whole lot more information into it. And we did a calculation. We calculated that, at least theoretically, you know, all I'm suggesting to you is entirely theoretical. We don't know if this works or doesn't work. It just seems to have the capacity. In theory, it has the capacity of a billion times the information density compared to standard memories that exist today. So a computer would be the size of a pinhead.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It's really amazing to think about the possibility.
Absolutely amazing, and it actually ties. Perhaps it ties with quantum tunneling. When we're speaking about the atomic level, then perhaps there's, because there is research done on quantum tunneling of water. For example, if I look at this article, there is a new state of the water molecule was discovered in a beryl crystal. So inside of the very small spaces, water goes into an hexagonal state. The scientists are describing very much like you have described your lattice, and because they are confined to very small measures or sizes or spaces, the atoms begin to tunnel. It seems so. I find this quite fascinating to connect with that ordered state of water that we even find in our cells. Perhaps there is much more to discover in living cells and in living water than we thought before.
Well, there's a lot more to be discovered. If there's one thing that I've learned is that we know so little. And it's so important to study the fundamentals, because we don't know what we're going to find. And we, as I said a moment ago, we don't know what we don't know. And one needs to be open. I've seen actually not just the report that you mentioned, which I've seen before, but other reports concluding states, issues, properties that are similar to what we already know exist. But these people are, I guess, unaware perhaps of some of our observations. Or, you know, sometimes it seems inopportune to quote papers or reports that seem too radical because it compromises your ability to publish. Those are political issues, but you know, we're focusing now on the scientific issues, not the political issues.
So if we're talking about this type of information that is there in the, let's say, regular 3D structure of the water, in that array of the hydrogens and the oxygens, can we relate this somehow also to our brain functions and to areas of consciousness? I know we are going into really areas that are more theoretical, but there's also the work of Stuart Hameroff and Roger Penrose, who have postulated that in the microtubules of the cell, which are also filled, obviously, with the water, and we've found, or scientists have found, Anirban Bandyopadhyay, for example, whose work perhaps you know, that there is micro oscillations in various bandwidths of these microtubules. So that would induce quantum oscillations inside those microtubules. And obviously, this would order the water as well in there. So perhaps there is a connection to the transfer of consciousness and thought. And maybe we need more than the brain. We need the whole body to think in that sense, and especially the water in the body.
Well, you raise so many questions. Let me first address the issue of microtubules. Microtubules, if you look at electron micrographs of microtubules, the electron micrographs are so crowded with solids that sometimes it's really difficult to make out what's what. But next to the microtubules, there are seemingly empty spaces, clear spaces with no molecular junk, which means, you know, there has to be something that excludes all of these solids. And I think that seems to me to be to point to evidence that around the microtubules, indeed, there's easy water. And so it's no surprise to me if that easy water around the microtubules is the substrate for storing information by whatever mode we speak about it. I presented one idea about how it might happen, but there are others, and some of these are sophisticated with sophisticated names and explanations that sometimes defy me. I don't know about you, but I have a hard time understanding them. I like to think simply. Yep. So yes, that is true. Now, in terms of consciousness and such, by the way, we started experiments looking at water because water and consciousness seem to be interrelated. And we have no definitive results yet, but we're taking, for example, a container of water and putting it on the desk and asking a healer to come and to project his or her consciousness on the water. And we test the water before and after and see if there's a change. And as I said, we don't have enough data for me to say anything definitive, but I'm hopeful that we'll see some change in the water. So a lot of people are thinking about that water being the logical medium for the storage of information. And one of the reasons the original findings by Jacques Benveniste, if you know that, yes, that story, were rejected, is that people couldn't imagine that water could store information. And if you think of ordinary liquid water, I can understand that, because liquid water, the molecules are randomly oriented and bouncing around a fierce number of times per second. How could that store information? But easy water is different, you see. And easy water does have that capability, and that's one of the reasons why we're so interested in pursuing this and trying to find out what is the mechanism. I'm not sure if if your listeners are so familiar with the particular experiments that have led to the idea of water memory.
That would be wonderful if you, yes.
Well, I'll skip the first one with the Jacques Benveniste. It's the most interesting story, but it's a long story, and I don't want to take up all of our time. The third book, my fourth phase of water book, describes that incident in great detail, mm-hmm. and it's shocking. The man basically lost his career because he was convinced that diluted, highly diluted water, like homeopathically, could contain information. He demonstrated it. Yeah. And he had colleagues repeat his demonstration, other laboratories, and it was simply too radical for Nature to publish it. And they caused him all kinds of grief, the mm-hmm. editor of Nature, and basically lost his career and finally lost his life. So that was the first, you might say, major event. And then secondly, it was observations of Masaru Emoto, which are very famous and known by a lot of people. Emoto was not a scientist; he was a spiritualist, and he would convey his intention to water. Then he'd freeze the water. Then he'd look at the ice crystals, and if his intention was positive, for example, love or peace or something like this, the crystals turned out to be beautiful. And if the intention was negative, like "I hate you" or something like this, or he would play heavy metal music or something to the water, the crystals were ugly. Now, these results are widely known. There are actually now two books, but. But he was a spiritualist, not a scientist, and that got him into trouble with the scientists because the way he did his experiments or his observations is he would freeze like 50 petri dishes, and then he'd look at all of them and he'd pick out the one that showed what he wanted to show. Mm-hmm. Scientists are somewhat reluctant to
accept it.
Cherry picking doesn't appeal mm-hmm. unless the cherry tastes really good. Then, you know, then it's okay. So he did that experiment, and a lot of people have been interested. Someone, perhaps you know, Veda Austin has done experiments beyond what he's done, and she's been able to show repeatability. I've been encouraging that, And so we have that. And then finally, there are many scientists who have presented different kinds of observations that are interpreted as water memory. And I don't want to go through all of those because it would take a lot of time. But these people appear. We organize the annual conference of the physics, chemistry, and biology of water. It's in its 15th or 16th year, I forget. And each time people come and make presentations. I'll just end with Luc Montagnier, because I think many people know Luc passed a year ago, and he had won the Nobel Prize for identifying HIV. And then he was a friend of Jacques Benveniste. And when Jacques died, he was so intrigued that he decided to shift his emphasis and study water and water memory. And his main experiment, I wouldn't say main experiment, but the most controversial experiment, I guess I should say, the most controversial experiment, which then he built on that, and other people have confirmed that, is he took two vials. One vial contained DNA in an aqueous buffer, a short strand, maybe 100 base pairs, and water. And these were separated in containers that were thoroughly sealed, that So nothing could be exchanged between the two. All they were is near one another. And he said that the information from the DNA or from the water surrounding the DNA is somehow being transmitted to this container of pure water. And to test his hypothesis, he used the PCR technique, which people know about now because you know, for COVID. So he used that technique. And indeed, he found that that he could get this new DNA from that water and the chemicals that are required that had the same sequence as this. So initially, there was huge disbelief. This couldn't be true because it's not only information transmission somehow, that's not chemical, but it's pretty complicated information transmission. It's been, or at least my understanding is now, it's been repeated by three different laboratories and confirmed, two Italian and one Chinese. So you know, if we take confirmation by other laboratories as truth, it looks like Montagnier's results are correct. They're true. So I've briefly presented to you a palette of observations ranging from the spiritualists like Emoto to Nobel laureates. There's a lot of information, and I believe this is going to be an area of the future. It will eventually work its way into, you might say, conventional science.
Absolutely, yes. I'm also working for this. We have this covered this a little bit also in the Wave Genome report, where I also go into the work of Luc Montagnier. And it's interesting that he used certain frequencies, 8 hertz, 7 to 8 hertz, in order to kind of transfer that information, it seems. And which takes me to one more question that I have before, because I know your time is limited. You have been doing work with Dr. Michael Persinger. I know that he has published in your journal, the journal, scientific journal, Water. And it seems that he has discovered that water and magnetism have a certain relationship. And what do you know about water and magnetism? Is this at all in your own research and horizon of interest? And how?
It's in our wheelhouse. We've never collaborated with Persinger, but you know, there are many scientists whose work appears in our journal. It's an ordinary research journal, and we receive manuscripts from all over the world, and his was one of them. And his work had been, I mean, really, really so interesting. So yes, the first is we immersed a magnet in water is the first one, and you know, you might expect nothing, but we found that, and the water contained the microspheres, and we found that that next to the North Pole, we could find an exclusion zone. In other words, next to the North Pole, all the microspheres moved away. And next to the South Pole, same thing happened. That's the first observation. So obviously, you know, magnets are having some impact on the water. Recently, the postdoctoral fellow in the lab has been working with the standard EZ setup, the one I've mentioned to you several times, and put a magnet just outside, and it seems the EZ is drawn to the magnet.
Indeed.
Yeah. So there's something profound going on. We don't understand it completely, but a third phenomenon that we found, and this is not published, it was done by an undergraduate, and we have an observation of if we take a tube, like a tube made of a polymer of Nafion, some kind of hydrophilic material, and we immerse the tube in water in a horizontal position, water flows through the tube. It doesn't stop. It just keeps flowing. And that's an interesting story by itself. So the student did experiments. He put a magnet, for example, here, right next to it, and it impacted the flow. And he changed the angle of it, and North Pole versus South Pole, and all of those had some impact. Unfortunately, he was an undergraduate student, and his wife gave birth to twins, and he graduated. So he had no opportunity to complete those studies, but the studies were interesting nevertheless. So I know that many people use magnets to improve their health, and a speculation that I would have, this is a speculation, is that those magnets build easy water in the cells underneath the magnet, and that's the reason for the improvement of health or an improvement of flow. But the answer, short answer to your question is yes, magnets have a big impact.
Wow, that's fascinating. And also, of course, the magnets have an impact on the brain, and there were certain correlations between water and the same magnetic pulses that Persinger was using. So this is all very fascinating because if we are not talking about water in the body, but you know, water is everywhere. It's even in the cosmos, and in a sense, it relates to that fourth state, not of water but of matter, that is the plasma state that we find throughout the cosmos. Is there any relationship in your thinking to that as well? I know that you are thinking about the weather and about cloud movement and water behavior. Would there be a relationship also to water clouds, hydrogen clouds, plasma clouds?
Well, I haven't thought about plasmas. They've always been confusing to me because I have a hard time understanding why positive and negative charges near one another won't just simply recombine. That's another issue. But yes, I think what you're alluding to is really important. The water's all over, and the question is whether easy water or fourth phase water is similarly all over, and what its role might be. So the first you mentioned is clouds, my next book, which is waiting for my artist son to complete the illustrations. He was busy with a home, his own home remodel, for 3.5 years. It was supposed to be 1 year, but it turned out 3.5 years. And so he's on it now, and we'll see what happens. But in the book, I have 4 chapters describing weather, and I think weather needs to be understood from basic fundamental principles, first principles of physics and chemistry on upward, because, you know, it's sort of seems obvious that something is creating those hurricanes, or the tides, or the clouds, and we need to understand it from first principles. I've tried to do that. Of course, I think I may have succeeded, but it's up to the beholder to see whether there's an agreement. But I do know that in the field, that atmospheric scientists there, this was whispered to me by an atmospheric scientist. He said, you know, there are 2 things that we don't know. Really, we don't understand: evaporation and cloud formation. So I deal with those extensively. And of course, it all has to do with water. And so some of the principles, or many of the principles that we've uncovered are, if they're valid, they're going to be applicable, and I think they are, and I think that I'm able to understand. So clouds, for example, I'm looking out my window in Seattle at Mount Rainier, and it's got a little cap on the top, a cloud that sits right here. Otherwise, the sky is pretty clear. And so a question is, how come? You know, someone would say, well, there's a cloud in the sky, and it's moving, and it hits Mount Rainier, and it somehow is blocked. But it can go this way, it can go that way, no problem. But it sits there, it's stuck to it. So why is it stuck to it? And I think the answer has to do with electrostatics, that the clouds are charged, they're negatively charged. And if you know the principle of Faraday induction, which is one of the few physical principles that, you know, that makes logical sense, it's simple and it's beautiful. So, you know, Faraday induction is, if you have, let's say, a positive charge here and a surface here, it's going to induce negative charge on the surface. You know, it seems intuitive that that's going to be the case. So if you've got a negatively charged cloud, it's going to induce positive charge at the top of Mount Rainier and the stick. Okay, but that's just one. The more general question is why do clouds sit in the sky? Clouds consist of little droplets of water, which sometimes do come down, but droplets are heavier than air. And why are they suspended? Why? And again, it has to do, I believe, with electrostatics. Another issue with clouds is each droplet has negative charge. They're not neutral. I demonstrated in the fourth phase book. And so you got one negative charge here and one negative charge here. And if I were to ask you, not you, because you're astute, somebody else, what do you expect? And they would say, well, they'll repel each other. and so how is it possible that a cloud can form if all these droplets, I mean, to form a cloud, they need to come together? And the answer lies in the writings of the great physicist Richard Feynman, who called this situation like likes like. In other words, like charged entities, they like each other, so they come together. And he said, like likes like because of an intermediate of unlike. So you've got positive charges here, negatively charged droplets, and that positive charge then attracts these negatively charged droplets and brings them together. But they don't coalesce because as they come closer together, then since each one of them has negative charge, they repel each other. But the positive charge brings them together. So a cloud, you can then form a cloud out of these negative charge droplets and positive charges that evaporate from the water in a way I describe in the book. Maybe, without background and diagrams, I shouldn't dwell on that. But there's a second. There are many issues, but I'm now in the process of working on a book about volcanoes and earthquakes. And I think water is centrally involved in all of those. It was discovered about 70 or 80 years ago that there's a source of water underneath the surface of the earth. It's called primary water.
Right.
And you've heard of primary water, yeah. Or Jupiter water, it's called. And it's estimated that the amount of water that is way beneath the surface of the earth, the volume is something like three times the volume of all the water on the surface of the earth. So down at the mantle, there's a lot of water. And it was found originally by a guy who was interested in mining. So he's a German who came to the U.S. and he worked in some mines in the Southwest where there's nothing but desert, dry area, no rain, very little moisture on top. And he was starting to dig for various minerals, digging in mines. And one day he took his pickaxe and he hit a rock, and suddenly the water came spewing out huge amounts of water and huge volumes. They almost died. They had to get quickly out of the mine. And they And he found, as he kept doing that in one mine after another, always in these dry places, water would spring forth. And so, you know, he raised the question, well, where is this water coming from? And eventually it became clear that there really is a source of water down beneath. So first of all, if there's water down below, if there's primary water, then is there a possibility that some of that water is easy water? Mm-hmm. You know, it turns out that some of the minerals that are found down there as detected inside some diamonds that somehow came up from one of the mines, it's called ringwoodite. And the ringwoodite contains OH minus, a lot of OH minuses, which is exactly what forms, what creates EZ. So if you have, if some of the water down there is EZ water, as we were discussing, whenever EZ water forms, protons form just beyond. Now, those protons repel each other. They're sitting in water. And then if they repel each other, they generate a force, right? The more protons you get, you can imagine a jar full of protons or hydronium ions, the more you put in there, the higher the pressure, you see? So it means that very likely down beneath the Earth is a source of water under pressure. And if you first think about springs, and maybe you haven't thought about that, but you seem to think about everything. You know, you find springs sometimes at the tops of mountains. The Himalayas have, I think the number was 3 million springs coming.
Incredible.
How does the water get up there? Under pressure.
Right? Yes.
And where I live nearby, people line up at a nearby spring just north of Seattle because they think the water is good for health, but few people ask the question, well, you know, how does the water rise to come out of these springs? You think of Yellowstone Park, you know, and Old Faithful, it's the spring blows every hour or so, you know, where does the energy come from? I'm proposing that the energy comes from the water, the protons, the protonated water that comes with easy buildup. And of course, the extension of that is volcanoes. You know, where does the energy come from for volcanoes? I can imagine the volcanoes contain huge amounts of water when they erupt, and also lots of charge, because if you look at the pictures of the photos of volcanoes, you can see electrical discharges, just like lightning cloud. So it's entirely possible that the energy comes from the water that's building up. And when it reaches, and it comes out of springs, you know, where there are fissures in the earth, but in these volcanic peaks where there are maybe no fissures or few fissures, the pressure builds up. And when it reaches high enough point, it blows. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've been thinking about. And
that's quite fascinating.
Well, you have to look at the evidence. I'm just giving you a gloss over and see if you... I'm also thinking about the atom. Maybe that's off topic because it's not water.
No. Nothing is off topic here. It's all about water.
Okay, so we all grew up learning about the solar system model of the atom, right? Nucleus contains protons and neutrons. Electrons are in orbits around, or now we would say electron clouds instead of electrons, the more modern view. And we all assume it's right. Of course, nobody can see an atom because it's too small. Right. And so you can't check to see, hey, is this model correct or is this model not correct? And I grew up thinking, well, of course it's correct. It's been around for five generations. Niels Bohr Well, I think he came forth with this model around the early 1900s or so. So I don't know how many generations that would be, but it's got to be right because it's been in the textbooks for so long. Well, you have to ask the question. I mean, as we're all scientists, does that model make sense to us, or are there some issues? And I think there are big issues. So the first issue is the nucleus. And this is an issue that the physicists have addressed, but I'll tell you anyway, because a lot of people are not aware. So the nucleus consists of protons and neutrons. The neutrons are neutral. They're kind of like extra baggage, for which I'm not sure anyone has suggested any real use. The protons have positive charges. And you know, when you pack positive charges tightly together, as in the nucleus, all they want to do is repel, get away from one another. And so how come the nucleus doesn't explode?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so this is not an original thought. A physicist 70 or 80 years ago came forth with acknowledged the problem, and they said, well, we think the model is right, and therefore there's got to be something to compensate for this. And what they invented is the so-called strong force, which is a kind of glue that holds all these positive charges together and doesn't do anything else, a special glue called the strong force. And since the logic is, since we know the model is correct, therefore, the strong force is a necessary condition in order to keep it correct. And therefore, it's one of the fundamental forces of nature, which it has become. But you know, it's there's no independent evidence for the existence of a strong force. It's a kind of invention of the physicists to make the model work, a patch, a big patch to cover a gaping wound. Electrons, the nucleus is positive, and the electrons are negative. I learned in middle school that negative and positive attract one another. So, question: How come the electrons don't collapse onto the nucleus,
right,
reducing the atom from its size to nothing?
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem, right? And how come the electrons want to gather in? Orbitals, you know, they really want to get away from one another. So the last thing they want to do is to congregate in those places. And then you got another electron coming in from outside. How does it know whether an orbital is full or not full? Because that's certain. And why doesn't it like better to reside in between the orbitals instead of in the orbit? I mean, those are. Questions so basic and so fundamental as to raise serious question as to the adequacy of the model. I've gone on to propose a new model. And the book is waiting. It's in line after waiting for my son, the artist.
Are you keeping us in suspense, or do you want to indicate what the new model?
Well, yeah, I can indicate what the new model is. But I can't go through the arguments that led to various, because that's going to take too long and involves some other discussion. It's basically a cubic model, and I should say as a preface that it's not so different from models that had been thought of by chemists early on. So when Niels Bohr came out with his model, it was embraced by physicists. This was the era of physics, you know, Einstein, Bohr, Planck, and all these people. It was not the era of chemistry. Chemistry was the previous century. So chemists were, you know, second-class scientists at the time. But there were some well-known, well-recognized scientists, and one of them, G.N. Lewis, we talk of Lewis bases, Lewis acids, and it was from his notes, which were reproduced in a book that I found recently, only recently, I didn't know, and And there's a diagram of pretty much the same as I'm thinking, as what he thought. And he and others, there was a quote from, it was either from him or another famous chemist. He said, this spherical solar system model doesn't even explain the simplest of chemical reactions. Therefore, it's going to be wrong. The chemist didn't embrace the physicist's idea, but as I said, it was the era of physics. Physics dominated, the model dominated. I believe it's wrong. This cubic model, it's not all cubic, but I don't want to digress. And it's got charges spaced within the volume of the cube, plus and minus charges. And they balance one another. It stems from what I was discussing earlier about Feynman's like, likes, like. But it turns out that if you look at colloid crystals, if you suspend colloids in a liquid, they actually take on a regular dispositions into a regular array, and they're stable. It's a stable array. And a Japanese scientist, Norio Isa, has demonstrated that the colloids usually have negative charge, and then you've got positive charges around them. And with suitable distribution, it's stable. Because they've demonstrated that the colloids can form crystals from which you can diffract light. So they're very regular in their organization. And I think the same principle applies at the atom, that you've got positive and negative charges that are within this cube that balance one another. Stability is critical. I mean, if you don't have stability, you don't have an atom. And this is a question
that
has not been seriously addressed. So for details, please wait.
I
hope the book will be out 6 or 9 months after the next book is one that contains discussion of weather and clouds and how birds fly and how fish swim and what gravitation is all about, et cetera, et cetera.
All based on easy water.
Well, a lot of it, yes. A lot of it's based on easy water. Yeah. And other concepts that have kind of become clear to me from thinking about easy water and all the implications of the underlying chemistry and physics. I've learned so much about chemistry and physics, having pursued myself, all of this. And if there's one lingering central paradigm that I particularly appreciate, is the paradigm of simplicity. Right, I see you nodding your head. Long ago, it was thought that simplicity pervades all of science. This is so-called Occam's razor. Sir William of Occam was actually a theologian, and he was talking about the existence of God, and he came up with this idea, which you know very well. You know, there are two ideas: God exists, God doesn't exist, and the simpler one is probably the one that is going to be right. Okay, so a few centuries later, Isaac Newton took his idea and he said, hey, this is cool. It should apply to science as well. And since he did, scientists, essentially almost all scientists, have adopted this paradigm that, you know, you got two hypotheses. The simpler one is probably going to be the one that prevails. We've deviated some from that with quantum mechanics and quantum electrodynamics, which are, you know, essentially abstract mathematics. And so that, I think, maybe has led science astray somewhat. But for me, it's such an important principle. If you have a complicated explanation or hypothesis that's really awkward to try to understand and explain to somebody else, the chances are that it's not that you don't understand it because you're not smart enough, but that it might be wrong.
Yes, I love that. And I noticed that in many of your interviews and in your books, that has been your maxim for a long time, I noticed, and it has led you very far. And it's has given us right now in this past hour a fantastic overview also of your mind cosmos, if I can call it this. If we can bring it back to once again to the water and in the cell, my final question would be, and maybe also the listeners would love to hear, how do you suggest that we can increase the easy water, the four space of water in our lives, in our bodies? It's obviously a part of health. Is it possible to drink easy water, or can we find waters that are more filled with easy than others?
Yes, all of the above. So first, I'll quickly go through six expedients. There are more that can build easy water in your cells. The first is just drink more water. And I'm guilty sometimes of not doing so. Some of the water will, thank you. Okay, we're in the same boat, so to speak. Some of that water will be converted into easy water. And, you know, that's the easy way. And easy water is essentially hydration. So you're hydrating, you think you're hydrating by drinking the water, but the real hydration at the cell level is the water that gets converted into easy water and fills the cell. That's one. Drinking water that contains easy is the second one. And there are various ways to do that. Spring waters, some of them, not all, some of them contain abundant amounts of easy water. Some companies are touting that their water contains fourth phase or easy or structured water. I'm not sure the extent to which it's true or not true. You know, they need to provide the evidence. Or you can do so-called juicing by going to your backyard and pulling off the leaves of freshly grown plants and squeezing them, squeezing out the water. And what are you squeezing out? You're squeezing out the water from inside the cell of the plant. Freshly grown leaves, full of easy water, healthy, and you drink easy water that way. And so, you know, and it's not, some people wonder, well, gee, how does the easy water that you drink get into your cells? And I think it's actually not the way it happens. I think that what happens is that you drink the easy water that's full of negative charge. Mm-hmm. It's not the water, it's the negative charge that right. quickly comes out and finds its way to regions that are lacking negative charge.
Yes.
And at the laboratory, we found if you add negative charge to water, easy, the water converts directly to easy. You don't
Incredible.
Need it creating surface. So I think that's actually the way that works. And I've heard from various health practitioners that it's really, really helpful no matter what issue you have. You know, drink that water and come back to the practitioner a few months later, and whatever issue you had has been improved greatly by
How can you charge negatively charged water, normal water?
Put an electrode in it.
Just that.
So I take the water, I put two electrodes, and if you look near the negatively charged electrode, you can find by techniques that we have that easy water grows as electrons come out of that negative. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple. Another one is to expose yourself to the sun. Sun's rays are, you know, I forget whether it's said to be 49 or 51% in the infrared wavelengths. And you know, in Seattle, where I live, the weather is kind of like London, and we in the wintertime especially we don't see a whole lot of sunshine, and when the clouds break and the sun comes through, people are happy, and the question is, you know, why are they happy? And the usual response is, well, we're happy because suddenly we have new light, and it's possible that it's a cycle. Purely psychological effect, But it's also possible that since the sun is releasing so much infrared energy, the infrared penetrates through our skull, which clearly it does, because you can do imaging of the brain from an infrared source outside. It penetrates the skull, goes in the brain, gets scattered, gets collected again, and you got an image. So some of that sunlight goes through. It hits the neurons and whatever else is important in cognition and such. And it builds easy water because infrared builds easy water. And because these, let's say, nerve cells are brought back toward normal, the default situation is we feel happy. We don't feel sad. We don't feel depressed or anything. So we feel good. And okay, so the fourth one is the extreme of that, and that is immersing yourself into a sauna, or as the Finns say, sauna, or the Russians say, banya. More or less the same. It's heat. Heat and infrared are not exactly the same, but almost, for all intents and purposes, similar. So you go into the sauna and you expose yourself, take off your clothes, expose your body to intense infrared energy. Walk out 20 minutes later, you're feeling good. And I think that that the secret may indeed be the infrared energy that builds easy water, and easy water in our cells to, so they're not dysfunctional. Okay, that's four. Fifth one. What's the fifth one? Oh yeah, herbs. Certain herbs. So from Ayurvedic times, 5,000, 10,000 years ago, various substances have emerged that seem to be good for health. And so, for example, turmeric is one of those, widely advertised as, hey, take turmeric, you'll be healthier. Or whatever it is, that issue that you have, take turmeric. Another one is basil, or so-called holy basil. Another one is coconut water, and et cetera, et cetera. And we tested a whole slew of those because we had the hypothesis that, hey, maybe these agents are so good for health because they build easy water. And it turned out, we published several papers, that was exactly the case. And as a control, we looked at glyphosate, the weed killer, and it did exactly the opposite. At every concentration, it diminished the amount of easy water. So we think, based on that there are certain herbs. We haven't tested all herbs, obviously, but certain herbs that have been known for many, many years to be good for health, maybe good for health because they build easy water. Finally, in the half dozen most sort of obvious ones, is grounding yourself, or so-called earthing yourself, connecting yourself electrically to the earth. So why would that be advantageous? Well, it turns out the earth is not neutral. Turns out the earth is negatively charged. And that came as a shock, so to speak, to me. When a Russian told me about this, and I said, I studied electrical engineering at my undergraduate, and no professor ever told me that if you stick a plug into the receptacle in the wall, that third prong is getting connected to anything but neutrality. He said, well, your education system must be poor, because in Russia, every middle school student knows that the earth is negatively charged. I confirmed that with some scientists who are of contemporary age. And yes, they're not learning it now, but they did learn it in the past.
Indeed.
I was skeptical, but when this Russian guy told me it, next morning, one of my students brought the famous lectures of Richard Feynman, and volume 2, chapter 9, it's a whole chapter containing all the evidence that the Earth is negative. So the evidence is there. It's just that we don't know about it. We don't follow it. Okay, so why is that important? It's important because if you can connect yourself electrically to a source of negative charge, that negative charge is going to pour into your body and feel regions that don't have enough negative, that are more positive than that negative charge. And as I said, that negative charge immediately converts water into easy water.
Easy water, yeah.
Yeah, and so there are many interpretations of what's really going on with when you earth yourself. Mm-hmm. And this is my own interpretation, and I think it's simple. Yeah. Excellent. So those are a half dozen, and let me just add one more because it's a little bit, it's not so simple, but it's important, and that is hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And you probably know that if you immerse yourself into one of these tubes and expose yourself to high oxygen and high pressure, you feel better. It was originally for wound healing, but there are now dozens of syndromes that are improved by that. And once again, the hypothesis that we had is, hey, you know, maybe somehow this builds easy water. So we tested it and published it. And high pressure builds easy water. High oxygen builds easy water. So I think this is the mechanism. So I've now given you seven of them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And if I may ask, is there maybe also cold? What about cold? Because if easy water is close to ice, would the cold exposure, we have done an interview with Wim Hof, I don't know if you have heard of him, the Iceman, breathing, he fills the body with oxygen first, and then you go into the cold water. Would that build easy?
Well, let me explain why that works as well as it does. So you're generating heat inside your body by metabolism. And if you think of the Earth, every night the Earth radiates to the cold, radiates heat to the cold in environment. And the same thing happens in your body. So it means if you expose the outside of your body to cold, not just to room temperature, but to cold, it enhances the loss of infrared energy from your body to the outside. So in other words, the core of your body is generating heat, and that heat will get dissipated to the room temperature. But if it's cold, it gets even more dissipated. So which means that the energy, the infrared energy, is passing through all the tissues of your body, passing through even more so than if you are in the normal environment. Mm-hmm. And I think if that's the case, then you got more infrared, we'll build more easy water, and you'll feel better.
This would be my interpretation. Yeah. Great explanation. Thank you very much for this.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Pollack, Jerry, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and the wealth of knowledge that you have. And we cannot wait for your book, and I hope to see you in hopefully the water conference that has been postponed will take place, and that we can meet in person then.
Okay, thank you so much,
and all the best.
Perceptive questions.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.